And good morning. This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Monday, March 29th. I'm Roz Brown. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio.
If a serious psychological workup were done on several of the more recent mass shooters, I think you'd be hard put to call them psychotic.
The reality was, when we are abundant and shopping as usual, we were able to make it.
This is not the first time the mass shooting happened in my community, and I have to build some sort of protection to not fall apart.
Those are some of the voices you'll hear on today's magazine. Coming up, since last week's shooting that took the lives of 10 at Boulder's King Soopers, there's been considerable speculation about whether the suspect was mentally ill. We'll talk to one expert who believes mass shootings are more likely to be about access to guns. Then many Boulder residents have felt compelled to write about their feelings about last Monday's shooting, and we've captured one of those heartfelt essays and we'll share it this morning. If you haven't heard, a beloved 50-year-old institution on Boulder's Pearl Street Mall is closing, a victim of COVID and the resulting loss of foot traffic in downtown Boulder. We'll have more. Following a commentary from Jim Hightower just after the BBC headlines at the bottom of the hour, KGNU's Miriam Schiff talks with on the Public Affairs Show today. She'll talk with filmmaker Harry Mavrommatidis about his feature-length documentary called Olympia, highlighting the work of actress and political activist Olympia Dukakis. As always, on Monday morning, it's Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting, followed by the Morning Sound Alternative, and Greg Schultz will be in today to spin some tunes for you until noon. But first, here's a look at headlines with Jamie Sudler.
The community's healing after last week's shootings at a King Superstore on Table Mesa Drive in Boulder continued over the weekend. 10 people died a week ago today in the worst killing in Boulder County history. In Boulder on Saturday night, many residents stepped outside their homes and took 10 deep breaths and stood silently for 10 minutes to honor the 10 victims. Denver 7 reports that some headed to the Memorial of Flowers outside the store where the shooting occurred. Earlier in the day, hundreds, if not thousands, of people stopped by at that memorial, many of them families with children. Many shed tears and others stood in silent prayer. On Saturday in Longmont, people gathered at 6th and Main Street to remember the lives of those who died. Some there carried a message demanding action for gun reform, with one sign saying, "Enough already." About 100 people gathered for a candlelight vigil Sunday in Lyons to honor those who died. Law enforcement officials continue to investigate the two firearms used by the suspect at the King Super shooting a week ago today. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Doherty said Friday that they are also looking into other firearms that may have been connected to the suspect, who has been charged with 10 counts of murder and one of attempted murder. The DA spoke along with Boulder Police Chief Maris Harold at a press conference outside the police department and in front of a memorial for Officer Eric Talley, who is one of those killed. Chief Harold said they are still searching for a motive for last week's massacre.
Like the rest of the community, we too want to know why. Why that King Supers? Why Boulder? Why Monday? And unfortunately, at this time, we still don't have those answers. The firearm used by the suspect in King Soopers on March 22nd is a semi-automatic Ruger AR-556 pistol. It was legally purchased in a gun store in Arvada, Colorado. The defendant was also in possession of a 9mm handgun, but at this time we do not believe that gun was used in this incident.
Harold said 26 law enforcement agencies have been working around the clock to investigate the mass shooting. Denver 7 reports that authorities conducted 156 interviews, collected 223 tips and leads, and gathered about 20 digital media devices over 4 days. Meanwhile, the union representative for some of the workers at the King Supers where the shooting occurred says there were problems with the store's security. CBS 4 reports that the United Food and Commercial Workers representative wrote to the food chain last week after the shootings. At a grievance meeting about 3 weeks ago, workers talked about a partially obstructed fire exit. The representative said there was a concern expressed then about an active shooter situation that might occur at a different store in Boulder. As part of the negotiations under the collective bargaining agreement at the Table Mesa location, the union asked King Supers to have an armed security guards at every store. However, the union says the grocery store chain rejected the idea. The union wants King Soopers to communicate better moving forward, including how employees will return to work, how they will be compensated for the time at the Table Mesa location as it remains closed, and how the company will handle mental health for employees. Colorado Governor Jared Polis will give an update this morning on the state's response to the COVID pandemic and vaccinations. As of yesterday, there are 323 people hospitalized with the coronavirus in the state. The seven-day average of positivity has increased slightly to close to 4%. Positivity is an important indicator of the status of the pandemic in the state. The World Health Organization recommends that the positivity rate be lower than 5%. Nearly 1,600,000 people in Colorado have received at least one dose of vaccine, with close to 1 million being fully vaccinated. Over the weekend, Denver activist and school board member Tay Anderson denied that he had sexually assaulted a woman. On Friday, Black Lives Matter 5280 issued a statement saying a woman approached the group in February and said Anderson had sexually assaulted her. The group did not name the woman or release details of the alleged assault, but said Anderson is not welcome at their meetings or events until he takes certain steps to be accountable. The Denver Post reports that Anderson said yesterday he would cooperate with any investigation into the allegations of sexual assault and misconduct made against him. During a news conference, Anderson said he could not fully address the claims without more details of the alleged incidents. Three former members of Never Again Colorado, a now disbanded youth organization for gun reform that Anderson led, told the Denver Post they witnessed sexual misconduct by Anderson, including unwanted compliments and unwelcome sexual advances. On Saturday in Denver, people gathered at the state capitol to rally against violence toward Asian Americans and Pacific Islander communities. The Denverite reports that hate crimes against people of AAPI descent were already higher last year and have now become an urgent national concern after eight people were shot in Atlanta a few weeks ago. U.S. Representative Jason Crow, who represents Aurora, was at the rally Saturday and said he has been reaching out to the AAPI and Muslim community. Crow described last week's events and those of the past year as mass trauma. The National Weather Service says we'll see mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 60s and very windy today with gusts as high as 60 miles per hour. Tonight, a small chance of rain and snow. Tomorrow, the chance of snow continues with mostly cloudy conditions and a high of 41. Sunny skies return Wednesday. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Last week, Boulder was added to an infamous Wikipedia page. It's called List of Mass Shootings in the United States. The Gun Violence Archive, a nonprofit research group that tracks shootings and their characteristics in the U.S., defines a mass shooting as an incident in which four or more people are shot in one location at roughly the same time, excluding the murderer. As you heard in headlines, police still don't know why Boulder or why King Soopers. Richard Burke is a professor of criminology at the University of Pennsylvania and tracks such shootings.
Access to firearms. That's the root of all this, because you're always going to have people who have an axe to grind who also have easy access to semi-automatic weapons. As long as you have that, they're going to be these things. So you have to go upstream and start restricting access to those firearms. And there's lots that can be done there if we have the political will. Moving back downstream to the particular individuals who might commit a mass shooting is extremely demanding and probably not practical. I mean, broadly speaking, I'd be very curious, for example, but if a serious psychological workup were done on several of the more recent mass shooters, I think you'd be hard put to call them psychotic. Now, they may have some neurotic tendencies, but so do we all. So I don't know if there's a clear line in the sand between folks because of mental illness pose a serious threat and the rest of us. So I think that's a loser. There are lots of really important questions for which we don't have answers, at least currently. I mean, we just don't know. And I mean, you see it every day, for example, in, let's say, which individuals are going to take the COVID vaccine. Well, we think we know some things that matter, but we really don't know that. even though it's a really important question. And there are a lot of public policy issues that are just like that. The questions are really hard. Put another way, if we knew the answers, we probably would have done something already.
Professor Burke says the Second Amendment, coupled with a sheer number of semi-automatic weapons throughout the country, make gun control options very challenging.
We know that there are, on the average, more guns than people. Yes, that's for sure. And some individuals have dozens. I mean, there's a lot of difference between individuals who have lots of guns and those who have none. But in this particular instance, this individual, what did he have, one gun or two? So, I mean, it's access to guns that allows this sort of thing to happen, particular kind of guns. But you could start by chipping away. I mean, the Boulder Ordinance, which I understand prevented high-capacity magazines, is certainly a step in the right direction. It's a small step, but it's a step in the right direction. It's not going to be terribly effective because you can go to the next city and buy a high-capacity magazine, but it's a step in the right direction.
Since the Boulder shootings and those in Atlanta the week before, many have advocated not for fewer guns or more gun laws, but that everyone should be carrying a gun to thwart events like the one in Boulder. Burke does not agree.
That's just empirically false. And then you have gunfire between people. My God, is that going to help? The claim that, you know, if we were all packing heat, these mass shootings wouldn't occur is just garbage. I mean, if you look at these mass shootings, people come in often with flak jackets, with semi-automatic weapons, with no warning and begin firing. Come on. It's just not going to make a difference. That's just silliness. That's too many John Wayne movies. Again, these kinds of claims, this is like conspiracy theories. These kinds of claims, if exposed to the light of day, the facts, would disappear. But unfortunately, many of the folks who state these kinds of things don't do their homework on the facts.
Burke says hearing about any mass shooting makes him sad, but he breaks the crime down into what's actionable and what's not.
My first reaction is sadness because there's no reason why this has to happen, and every homicide is a tragedy. My second reaction is that actually many more people are killed in usual kind of gun violence. Every day we had 400 homicides, almost 500 homicides by guns in Philadelphia last year. And that's not atypical. More people die in sort of everyday garden variety shootings than ever get killed in mass shootings. That's also a tragedy and makes me sad. And then there is, as you point out, the frustration. Surely we should be able to do some things, but the progress so far is really disappointing. Again, you go upstream to the firearms. There's actionable stuff there if we have the political will. But focusing on the psychological or social characteristics of different possible shooters, I think, is a loser.
Burke adds that there are examples of gun violence where various kinds of surveillance can be undertaken, assuming that criminal justice agencies properly follow through.
There will be, of course, obvious cases. You mentioned domestic violence, where orders of protection can be really helpful if they are implemented properly and the police actually take away the guns. Very commonly, we go to actionable again. We do something that could make a difference, but then it's not acted upon as designed. But if it's acted upon as designed, there will be circumstances like that because a large fraction of mass shootings are related to domestic violence. The woman is leaving the guy, he loses it, he kills her, he kills the kids and maybe her parents. That's sort of a very common kind of mass shooting, and we should be able to do stuff about that. But again, in general, I'd go upstream to the guns.
Again, I was speaking there with Richard Burke, professor of criminology and statistics at the University of Pennsylvania. It's 8:17 on the Morning Magazine. People respond to tragedies like the one Boulder experienced last week in different ways. A traumatic experience causes a threat to our safety and potentially places our own life or the lives of others at risk. As a result, a person experiences high levels of emotional, psychological, and physical distress that temporarily disrupts their ability to function normally in day-to-day life. Well, Boulder photojournalist Lucia DiGiovanni wanted to write about her reaction. Here's what DiGiovanni wrote and shared with KGNU.
My name is Lucia DiGiovanni. I'm a photojournalist based in Boulder, Colorado. The title of my blog post on March 24th, 2021 is Why? I am at a loss for words today. On March 22nd, 2021, my beautiful Boulder community suffered an unimaginable tragedy. Watching this unfold in my backyard felt so overwhelming. I went numb. I saw the worst in humanity in this senseless act of violence, but also in the frenzy that ensued in the media to be the first to cover the news. Tragic in all senses. I spent yesterday trying to gather my thoughts. My first instinct as a photojournalist was to run towards the unfolding news. But yet again, this was happening in my community. I stopped. I cried. I didn't know what else to do. There is something inside of me that blocks me still from understanding the full extent of my feelings. I was afraid to break, but also afraid I no longer can. This is not the first time a mass shooting happened in my community, and I had to build some sort of protection to not fall apart. But that wall is so high now, nothing can get in, and nothing can get out. I no longer know what's appropriate when responding to trauma, to pain and suffering. I'm scared of feeling like a vulture, exploiting the feelings of all the people who are suffering, but I'm in pain as well. I want to showcase beauty in my photography, always, and I thought I would be incapable of doing so in this tragic circumstance. I usually stay away from collective displays of grief. I always have, and I never want to take advantage of someone's pain. It is my intention with these photographs to bring dignity to our loss. I can't imagine the pain of these families. I feel like the only thing I can do is my job. With the care and love in my heart, that will bring to light the best of humanity. The care, the love, the sense of a community that is deep in grief, yet willing to embrace one another in it all. Today, one of the King Supers employees that I used to see at the store all the time gave me a hug. A deep, heartfelt hug. And I cried in her arms like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. I put a white tulip on the fence. I said a prayer. I hugged the comfort dog. I did my job. I am older strong.
Again, thoughts about last week's tragedy from Boulder Folder journalist Lucia Di Giovanni, and our thanks to her for those thoughts.
Support comes from Centennial Peaks Hospital, offering help for listeners or their loved ones who may be experiencing a mental health crisis. Inpatient and outpatient services available from a medical staff of independent practitioners. ECT available for treatment-resistant conditions. Details at centennialpeaks.com.
It's 8:22 here at KGNU. A shop is closing on Boulder's Pearl Street Mall. Of course, that happens a lot, but in this case, it's an art co-op with deep ties to the community, and for many, its closure has added to so many other things we lost during the year of COVID-19. KGNU's Ginger Perry brings us the story.
This is Ginger Perry of KGNU, and I'm here with Ellen Spiller and Steve Briggs of the Boulder Arts and Crafts Gallery. The gallery is closing after 50 years, which has everybody in Boulder heartbroken. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning, Ginger. Thanks for having us here.
I guess people want to know just why the Arts Co-op is closing now after 50 years.
You're starting with the hard question. You know, I think that there are many reasons why. I think, obviously, COVID has had its impact. The store was closed while all of the businesses in Boulder were closed. And then we took about another month to reopen. We kind of wanted to test the waters and make sure Pearl Street was a safe environment, and people were, and we had to figure out what was going to make us safe in our store. So we reopened about a month into after most people did, and we tried many strategies for making our store inviting and safe. We opened it up a lot, so the atmosphere would be spacious. We continued to have our doors open. We worked on many things to be successful.
But you only got down to 30% of what you usually had sold, right?
Exactly. So whereas I think that one of the things that I would like to say about the co-op, because we are a co-op, is that we have always not had profit in mind. What we have wanted to do was to be in business to help support all of the artists that we represent and to have enough revenue left over to pay our expenses. And our business is in one of the most majestic storefronts on Pearl Street. And
not to mention most expensive.
And I was just going to add the most expensive. And so the reality was, when we are abundant and shopping as usual, we were able to make it. And when shopping ramped down, there was no way that we could make the expenses that we had.
Steve, what's the criteria for members to be part of this co-op?
Well, they have to apply, and then we have a committee that looks at their work and talks to them. And we have been inviting people in for a long time. That was really one of the problems. We didn't have an influx of young blood in our organization. We have always been welcoming for new members, and they just have to be committed artists and kind of feel that they can be part of the whole co-op approach to things.
And how many do you have now in the dwindling numbers?
Well, our membership, and that is the primary concern here, our membership has gone from the 75 at our peak to now there are 18 of us.
And what different kinds of art is in here, Ellen?
Oh, we represent so many different mediums. We have pottery, of course. Steve and I are both potters. We have fiber. We have jewelry. We have leather. We have woodworking, we have painting, we have photography, we have glass. The list goes on.
You have beautiful cards, too. Well, losing that foot traffic during the COVID really created a huge impact, I'm sure. And so many places have been affected by the virus. But you've had a real outpouring of love. Tell me about that.
Since we announced our 50th anniversary sale and the closing of the co-op, we have had lines from our front door around the corner. They stretched a half a block long, and people are coming in and sharing their love for us and mourning our loss and telling us again and again and again how they will miss our presence here on Pearl Street. That we have been the go-to place for them to find their gifts, their birthday gifts, their anniversary gifts. We've also been the place where they have brought their friends and family when people have come from out of town. We act like a destination. And we're part of the community, and people happy to associate us as part of their lives.
Yeah, it's a local institution, and both tourists and locals come here, I'm sure. And you've gotten letters and emails.
We have gotten such an outpouring of support and love, like I say, love letters and condolences from our artists and from the community. It's just been amazing.
And you told me a story about a magician that came in. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this story is that one of our artist members, Kevin Brady, who lives up in Lyons, has produced this hand-turned wooden wand, magic wands. And he's been making them for probably about 30, 35 years, I'm thinking. Yesterday, a man who was probably in his early 30s or so came into the store, and he was looking at the wands. The wands command a lot of attention here. A lot of people come up to the case where they are, and they go, "What are these?" And we go, "Magic wands, of course." So this gentleman was looking at the wands, and he was reminiscing about, he said, "I used to come in here when I was 8 years old with my mother, and we would come and we would look at the wands, and this is reminding me of my trips with my mom to the co-op," and he got a little teary when he said that. And he says, "I've been wanting a wand for so many years, and when my friends would come to town, I would come in the co-op and I'd show them the wands." He says, "Today's the day. I'm going to buy my wand today." And he's going on and on with his story about how much these wands mean to him. And there was another customer at the counter listening to him go on and on about the wands. And before we knew it,
The other gentleman says to the first man, he says, "Did you buy your wand yet?" He goes, "No, I'm still picking it out." He goes, "Well, you pick one because I'm going to buy it for you."
And that was Ellen Spiller speaking to KGNU's Ginger Perry. Spiller is the owner of the Boulder Arts and Crafts Gallery on the Pearl Street Mall. The gallery will close on April 4th after 50 years of serving the Boulder community. It's 8:28. This afternoon at 3 o'clock, we have KGNU's Metro Show, and as it is Boulder Arts Week, host Miriam Schiff will speak with Lauren Click about what's going on this week. Here's a preview.
Art's always been the vehicle that brings people and communities together. And you've talked a little bit how the Boulder Arts Week can do this.
Well, so last year, the closures happened about a week before the 7th annual Boulder Arts Week. And we still had 40 programs online, all online, virtual, a week later, which to me shows the kind of creativity and resiliency and power of the artistic community.
Again, tune in at 3 o'clock this afternoon for Metro to hear the entire story about Boulder Arts Week.
Support comes from Colorado Tech Point, a technology store specializing in sales and repair service of verified pre-owned laptops, computers, and mobile devices. Located at 436 Main Street in downtown Longmont. More information at co-techpoint.com or by calling 303-848-3738.
And this from the Boulder Museum today. The Boulder Museum at Broadway and Pine is following the example of museums in other cities where tragedies such as the one that occurred in Boulder last month have also taken place, and they are planning to preserve community stories. The museum will collect memorial items for long-term preservation. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to the museum site. That's collections at museumofboulder.org. They eventually hope to also have oral histories from those who were affected.